Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenrigg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you this Thanksgiving week?
Oh, I'm thankful for you guys and for all of our listeners.
I'm so happy Peter. To be talking about movies with friends.
Yeah, don't...
And the turkey is coming.
No sappiness here. All right. Many thanks, as always, to the folks listening to this on Tuesday. If you're listening to this on Tuesday, you're helping to keep this thing sustainable. We hope everyone's enjoying their Thanksgiving week. If you've been traveling with us yapping in your ears, just remember that green bean casserole is the number one best Thanksgiving side, and not like the fancy bullshit green bean casserole with like fresh green beans and everything. You just need to slop a bunch of things in cans together and heat them up and then sprinkle onions on top. That's God's food right there. And now on to controversies and non-troversies.
Sonny, we've gotten the Thanksgiving at my house.
We've gotten the non-troversy out of the way. Let's get to the controversies. We are checking in on the sale of Warner Brothers this week, as there are a couple of small pieces of news worth chewing over. First up is the news that Netflix is making a bid and, according to Lucas Shaw at Bloomberg, has committed to releasing movies in theaters. Kinda. Here's Shaw, quote, Warner Brothers has contractual agreements to release movies in theaters, which Netflix would honor, according to the people who asked not to be identified, revealing details of talks between the companies, end quote. Now, that is not a commitment to theatrical, as I think any of us really properly understand it. It's a report with an enormous amount of wiggle room. One could argue that Netflix already has a theatrical component, right? They release their movies in theaters. I saw Frankenstein in a theater in 35 millimeter, right? They had Train Dreams was playing near me. Jay Kelly is getting a rollout. They do it, right? And we saw during the pandemic what a theatrical release really constitutes can be massaged, right? As when Disney tried to do the day and date releases in theaters and on PVOD simultaneously with movies like Black Widow or Raya and the Last Dragon. Or when Warner Brothers itself, the company that's up for sale right now, released an entire year's worth of movies on HBO Max and in theaters simultaneously. I'll just say that I'm skeptical that Netflix would be as committed to theatrical as any of the other suitors, simply because Netflix wants movie theaters to die. Netflix wants movie theaters to die because they, A, compete with screen time at home, and B, they increase the cost for Netflix, which has to buy out back end and pay talent more to make up for that lack of a theatrical component. Movie theaters dying would be an absolute winner for Netflix. They would love it. Meanwhile, everyone seems to believe that Paramount remains in pole position for the purchase, in no small part because of the corruption in the federal government. It's not just that Trump administration is friendly with David Ellison, the owner of Paramount, and that his father, Republican donor and Oracle owner Larry Ellison, is obviously very involved here. It's also that the Trump administration would love to get CNN under the control of the Ellisons in order to potentially neuter yet another news outlet, as happened with CBS News and 60 Minutes. Comcast is reportedly on the outside looking in because, of course, Donald Trump hates the head of NBC due to its cable network's coverage of the Trump administration. Peter, which is worse? Which of these two scenarios is worse? Netflix buying the studio and essentially killing movie theaters by cutting out a quarter of the releases every year, or this crazy interference by the government on a sale of this nature?
I think you have to answer this question first, because this is obviously a split the baby, Sophie's choice, like, rock and a hard place scenario for it's the classic, like, no win for Sonny here, right? Because your choice, Sonny Bunch, is Donald Trump gets to own. Donald Trump gets more influence with a friendly owner of CNN, and there's a whole lot of corruption from the West Wing. Or the end of movie theaters, maybe. Which do you prefer, man?
I don't know. It's a thing I think about a lot. And I would say that I would probably have to go with preferring Paramount to own Warner Brothers than preferring Viacom, Paramount, whatever, to own the Warner Brothers Discovery conglomerate than having either than having Netflix own it. There are other suitors out there. You know, Apple's maybe considered, but I don't think Apple has made an official bid. NBC Universal would be fine, though. Both NBC Universal and Paramount have the same kind of problem, which is that they both have theatrical slates of their own. There would be fewer movies released in theaters, and that's bad for the theatrical ecosystem. So, like, basically, no matter what happens, no matter who buys it, unless it's Apple, and Apple's probably not going to buy it, it's bad.
My opinion about this is that the thing I am most worried about actually is the political corruption and the kind of managing this straight through Trump or Trump's people or through the White House, even if it's done implicitly. The reason I am worried about that is because when you do a deal this big and this important for the media industry, and remember, this isn't just Warner Brothers, right, and Batman and all of that, it's Harry Potter, right, all the IP, it's CNN as well, and that is, as you said, the Trump administration's main interest here. When you start to degrade the ability of the media to do its, not, let's just forget the free speech part of it, to do its business. This is business side interference. And that's what worries me. And I think there's a case to be made, which you basically just did, Sonny, that in some ways, Paramount is probably the best buyer for movies as an art form. But I'm worried actually a little bit more about I'm worried about more than just movies as an art form. I'm worried about the kind of the deepening of the corruption in the marketplace. And I want to see from this is for a transaction to happen that doesn't have direct or even implied political threats attached to it. And whichever buyer ends up winning, then that's what should happen. And my worry is that whether or not the Trump administration is making overt threats here or not, right? It seems like it's mostly implicit, but it is, does, there is a bunch of reporting that suggests, again, it's suggestive, not, not on the record clear, but that suggests that part of the bid from Ellison and Co. is, hey, we're the only company, we're the only bid that can get through merger approval with the Trump administration. I don't like to see that. I don't like business being done that way in America.
And I think part of the problem is that I don't know that there's any scenario where something not great doesn't happen to CNN, because part of the challenge here is that Paramount, Viacom Paramount is the only company that wants to buy CNN along with the movie assets. And so, you know, is CNN going to stay sort of an independent company? Is, you know, is David Ellison just going to say, okay, I couldn't get my hands on the movie IP, but like, I'll buy CNN and pair it up with CBS in some way? So it strikes me that there is not a version of all of this that doesn't involve, you know, something sort of untoward happening with CNN. I mean, you know, I can see a scenario where NBC, having just spun off MSNBC, is sort of, you know, if it doesn't win the auction, is able to get CNN, but it doesn't really seem like they want to be in that business right now. And so, you know, I worry that there is no scenario that both protects movies and protects, you know, even a slightly less concentrated media system.
I want to sort of make two separate points here. One is, if I want to make a hopeful case for movies, even if Netflix buys Warner Brothers here, it's that art forms that work, right, that have a market for them, somehow or another win out. Right. Like, and we don't know exactly how that's going to work. Right. But what we want is for a market to remain free of political interference, mm-hmm. for that to happen. And so that is why we're worried more about that political interference. But this is all part and parcel of what we're already seeing with the Trump administration. And this is, you know, a show about movies and about art and about pop culture and about the business of pop culture. But right now we are seeing the Trump administration basically take stakes in a bunch of companies. Intel among is probably the most prominent here. The cover story of Reason magazine this month by my colleague Eric Boehm, the two-word title is Republican Socialism, because that is what is happening. We have a personalist, Caudillo-style government that is sort of increasingly just sort of taking control of big deals that have political importance, and that you don't want to bring that into the world of media, into the world of movies, into the world of news and journalism. And frankly, I was bothered by, it wasn't the same thing, but I was bothered by the Biden administration's approach to antitrust, which was reflexive, ideological, sort of opposition to absolutely every merger. And part of the problem with that was, well, there were two problems. One was the reflexive opposition to every merger was kind of dumb on its face. I guess there might have been one or two mergers that there wasn't reflexive, but like nearly every merger. It was dumb on its face, but it also created an opportunity for political corruption later on. Similarly, with Biden's totally failed and sort of just incredibly misguided industrial policy, when you start taking stakes in companies and thinking that that's the job of the president of the United States, you're paving the way for someone like Trump to do a lot worse and to abuse it in ways that we are seeing right now. And so what I want to see is for that to not be happening, because I don't think that journalism can thrive in an environment in which a guy in the White House, whether you like him or whether you hate him, is making the decisions rather than the market and the people who own the companies.
Yeah, and the kind of secondary, there's another issue here that is kind of under the radar. Nobody seems to know quite what is going on, and that is that Paramount's head, David Ellison, has met with the Saudi sovereign fund to, you know, possibly potentially do some deals, which I don't know. I don't want the Saudis coming in and buying Warner Brothers either. That's
totally in the realm of kind of rumor reporting right now. We have no idea exactly
The deal in question here is an enormous deal. I mean, we're talking about tens and tens of billions of dollars. Like, David Ellison and Larry Ellison have a lot of money, and they could pay for this. That's a thing they could do. But it is, you know, we're talking about enormous sums.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I worked at The Washington Post when Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. And I find the idea of Mohammed bin Salman having any influence at all in media anywhere in the free world just unbelievably repulsive. And again, this is rumor. I hope it is not true, but that would be just a really disgusting conclusion to this story, for that man and that regime to have any influence on the American media. It's something that, you know, Trump has downplayed this, has sort of excused all of it, and it's something that everyone should find completely intolerable.
Yeah.
I should also say, I don't find David Ellison personally, like, out, forget the deals that he may or may not be doing. Again, it's so hard to even figure out what those deals might be or what's happening. But like, I don't find David Ellison's ownership on its face to be a bad thing. Like, that does not strike me as bad. What strikes me as worrying is the meddling from the White House and the way that that is being used to sort of as an advantage in the negotiations here.
Right. I mean, this is the crux of the matter, and this is the only reason why, frankly, I would find it to be controversial. I mean, we can talk about the merging of the major film studios and blah blah, but this is very much like the Jimmy Kimmel situation, where like mm-hmm. Jimmy Kimmel being taken off the air because he said something stupid and people got mad at him is not in and of itself a four alarm fire situation. The problem was the implicit and explicit threats by the head of the FCC and the Trump administration against the business interests of ABC, Disney, et cetera, if they didn't punish him in some way. As well as
the implicit threat for a pending merger that was going to have to go through the Trump administration approval for the local stations.
Right.
Right. I know that like antitrust bringing it back has been the new hotness for the left for a decade plus here. But you do that for ideological reasons, and people like Trump are going to come along and do it for personalist corrupt reasons.
Yeah.
You got to have guardrails.
The guardrails have served us so well over the last 10 years.
Well, we haven't had them.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that basically there's no good solution to the Warner Brothers the situation here? Peter?
This is all kind of controversial. I mean, anytime you have, rumors that are being reported in notable papers that the White House is intervening in a major media merger, like that's a controversy.
Alyssa?
It's a controversy. We're in a bad place with the independence of the media from this administration.
It is insanely controversial. I can't believe we're even having this discussion. All right. Quick programming note. Our bonus episode this week is going to go out on Friday because we figure you'll probably have plans on Thursday to be with your family or be too drunk on turkey and football to listen to a podcast. So no show Thursday. We're going to publish it on Friday instead. You're not going to want to miss it because it's going to be the first of hopefully many years of gift guides. We're doing a gift guide this year. And also, speaking of gifts, by the way, we're going to be running a sale on the Dashery store. There's going to be a sale on all of our merch. There's going to be a merch sale, people. I don't understand how their pricing algorithm works, but the stuff will be cheaper in some fashion. So I don't know. You go buy now. All right. Now on to the main event.
You know what also makes a good gift? Substack subscriptions to movies podcasts.
That's my understanding.
Let's put it out there.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There was probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
All right. Now on to the main event. Wicked for Good. Now, as longtime listeners know, I am not a musical guy. Not a musical guy. They just don't do much for me. I don't love musicals. Not my thing. Wicked Part 1 was no exception. I didn't love it. But I did at least understand why people who do like musicals would have liked Wicked Part 1, right? It had this infectiously fun performance by Ariana Grande. It was bright and colorful and fun, and it hit the emotional beats with real oomph. Again, fun, killer songs, right? Some fun dancing. So much fun. So much fun was had by all. Not by me, of course. I did not have fun. But I got to understand why people would have fun while they watched it. I do not feel that way about Wicked for Good, a movie that is dark and dour and is overstuffed and overlong. It doesn't hit any of the emotional beats with any real force. It compensates for none of that by featuring zero fun, catchy tunes. I genuinely do not see how people could like this movie. I don't understand how people could like this movie. It's bad. It's a bad movie, even on its own terms, as a musical. I will say I went to go see it with my, I took my daughter to go see it. On the Thursday night it came out, and I was like, did you like that? And she was like, yeah, I like that. It was okay. But she loved the first one. She loved the first one. She's watched it a half dozen times at the home on Peacock. She'll just turn it on and go to the songs. I do not think she felt the same amount of love for this one, just reading between the you know, 10-year-old girl lines. The film picks up a few years after the first. Elphaba is now the Wicked Witch of the West proper. She spends most of her time trying to disrupt the construction of the Yellow Brick Road while also rescuing the animals who are being oppressed by the overwhelmed, frankly, Tinkerer Wizard and his mouthpiece, the evil Madame Morrible. I want to dwell on the animal thing just for a minute here, because it's fairly indicative of the film's whole problem, right? All right, so the wizard and Madame Morrible want to scapegoat the animals to distract from things. What things? What are they like? Why are these animals being scapegoated? What is wrong in the Land of Oz? Like, what is the actual like crisis that they are trying to blame on the animals to distract from their own failures? How are the animals depicted as responsible for any of this? There's none of this makes any sense or is explained at all. It's just a signal and a signifier that says, we were discussing this in chat. It's not even really subtext. It's just the text. It's like, this is Nazi Germany and the animals are Jews. And like, okay, we're supposed to just kind of take this for granted that it's very important and that Elphaba's mission is just and that the people of Oz would all just accept what is happening here because reasons. None of it makes any sense. Doesn't make any sense. Anyway, Glinda is trying to fit in as a witch without any powers. She's the good witch. She doesn't have any powers. She can't do anything. She's got a little bubble car that she rides around. She and the Prince Fiero are engaged. I think that's his name, Fiero. I don't know. Despite the fact that he continues to harbor feelings for Elphaba, Elphaba's sister, the wheelchair brown Nessa Rose, is now in charge of Munchkinland, and she is using her powers to force the long-suffering Bach into her employ, despite his desire to go to the Emerald City and profess his love to Glinda. Bach's an interesting character in this movie because there's a version of this movie that is told from his perspective, and it's so much more interesting as a result because he is a guy who has been made to suffer because of the actions of Elphaba and her sister. Long story short, he gets turned into the Tin Man in a horrifying body horror sequence that's like something out of a David Cronenberg movie or Tetsuo the Iron Man. Contra the weird thing with the animals, right? Bach is a guy who's suffering. We understand. We see it on the screen. His life has been made worse by everyone else in this movie. But we don't spend any time with him or with Dorothy, whose face we never see on purpose. That's an intentional thing. We don't really see the whole, you know, band of goons that are going to kill the Wicked Witch because we're supposed to identify with the Wicked Witch in this movie. Anyway, I'm sure I just don't get this all because I'm a man. Look at me. I'm saying that the man, Bach, should be the focus of this movie. I can't get it. I don't understand. Alyssa, I don't think you're a man. Is this, in fact, an epic statement about sisterly love and girl power? Or is it just bad?
One, I can confirm that I am, in fact, a lady. This movie is a disaster. And I want to start off what I'm going to say by asking you two a question. And I promise this is relevant. What did you make of the weird sex cardigan?
Wait, there's a cardigan?
Were you asleep for this part of the movie? So
no, they had sex, but there was a cardigan?
Elphaba hooks up with the prince, and she puts on like a big cozy blanket cardigan thing.
I would have just called it a blanket.
Okay, but what did you make of it? How did you interpret it?
You know, they're cozy.
I didn't make anything of it. I don't know. It's
cozy just, time. This movie has an obsession with a very particular kind of like almost Instagrammable cozy aesthetic that I think is intended to hit a particular type of viewer. The first one was more successful in that, though I hated it because I'm not that type of viewer. But like it just sort of struck me as like, oh, this is a little cozy design detail. But not anything more than that.
I don't know. It just looked like something. I was like, is she cold? Is it cold there this time of year? What's
Alyssa, do
on?
You want to interpret the fabrics?
You seem to have a lot of thoughts about this.
I have a lot of thoughts and feelings about this like non-sexy cardigan, right? And I think it actually is emblematic of why this movie is terrible. So this is meant to be sort of a major moment in the movie, right? Like Elphaba and Fiero have done a lot of sort of passionate staring. They've bonded over the animals, you know. He's sort of supposed to be dating Glinda because he's popular and, you know, Metamorable kind of forces them to get engaged by springing a public engagement on it. And so this is supposed to be like, you know, and Fiero like runs off in the middle of his own wedding and like saves Elphaba and like they're going to bang. It's a big deal, right? And the movie totally undercuts its own sort of adultness or emotional coherence by, like, they get back to Elphaba's treehouse, like, Jonathan Bradley, who plays Fiero, is, like, taking off his suspenders, like, stuff's going down. And Elphaba, like, puts on this thing that resembles truly most closely, like, this enormous fuzzy robe my mother sent me when I had my second baby as, like, sort of a symbol to relax, as if it had been, but it looks like it had been attacked by moths. And it is just, like, it's a total breakdown of what had been in the first movie, like really excellent costuming by Paul Tazewell, right? It's like, it's a piece of clothing that like, not only doesn't sort of match the mood, but like actively sort of obscures and undermines what's happening in the scene, right? Like it is almost as if the scene, like it's almost as if John Chu is afraid to make the scene like too hot.
Absolutely. It's a PG rated movie.
Yeah, it's a PG movie.
When I said a certain Instagram crowd, it's like teenage girls, some of whom with a PG rated movie are not going to be, you know, adults.
100%.
This movie goes out of its way to appeal to them, I think.
Right. But I think that, you know, it is that the need for that, I mean, and I understand like all of the business reasons that this needs to be PG, but from sort of storytelling purposes, the need to inject this sort of, you know, just distasteful, discordant note in a way that sort of saps what's supposed to be sort of the climax of the movie, or like the climax of at least, you know, part of the movie of its Hi-yo. Power is, is... Like it is a weird breakdown of both the emotional storytelling and the sort of aesthetic care of the movie. And, you know, I doubt either of you have read the source material that Wicked is based on, but it is much darker and more grown up.
Do they explain the animals?
Yes, they do explain the animals somewhat more in the novel. And, you know, this is the movie just can't get there on any of its big ideas or emotions because of the need to be sort of PG in a certain way, right? Like, you know, there is not like Elphaba is ostensibly like a political organizer, but what she's basically doing is the equivalent of like posting Orange Mad Bad on Twitter, right? Like she's doing skywriting. She like, you know, frees some rhino oxen, right? Like there's no, you know, as Sunny said, there's no theory of what, you know, the wizard and Madame Morrible are, you know, covering up or hiding, like what their deeper policy for Oz is. There's no sense of like why they're doing this to the animals. It's just, I mean, it's literally a movie that deploys animal cruelty to get your sympathies, right? It's sort of like the cheapest trick in the book. It's like the villain is mean to dogs. Being mean to dogs is very bad. We are pro, I think we're an objectively like pro kindness to dogs podcast. But there's just no reason or weight for anything. And there is an interesting political idea here, but it's one that would require Elphaba to be the villain, right? And it's that Glinda's theory of change, the idea that, like, you know, heads of state and political leaders, like, did they have brains or knowledge? Don't make me laugh. They were popular, right? There's, you know, this movie is sort of an argument for, like, actually winning through persuasion and, like, making people like you and, you know, sort of setting up political scenarios that, like, allow you people to sort of see your arguments. But for the movie to make that argument effectively, it needs to say that Elphaba is wrong, and it can't do that, right? It can't. There is just no adult emotion in this movie. And it's just, I mean, it's a mistake. It's, you know, that is what shows up in sort of every moment of failure in this movie, right? Like, Elphaba shows up and like hectors the animals who are leaving, maybe sort of metaphorically for the state of Israel through a hole in the yellow brick road. She's like, you have to stay, you have to fight. Why? Right? I mean, she has no argument about like, what are they going to fight for? Like, they're literally being stripped of their intellect and their voices. She has no plan for them to win. Like, it's actually a sort of repulsive scene in a way, and that she's just like, she has no theory of how she's going to help anyone. But the movie can't, you know, Elphaba says to Glinda at this moment when she sort of, you know, sets up Glinda's like kind of sister soldier mode that, you know, the people need someone to react against so Glinda can be good, right? But the movie doesn't actually have the guts to explore the extent to which Elphaba's whole sort of view of the world and stubbornness are a mistake, right? It can't, you know, it cannot deal with the darkness of what she and Nessa Rose do to Bach. Can't even deal with sort of the ugliness of like what she does to Fiero, right? Like, she saves his life, but she turns him into the scarecrow, which is certainly going to make for like interesting sort of future sexy times and like the waste beyond Oz. But, you know, what do I know about any of this?
And the movie also,
I'm looking forward to the version that AI produces from your prompts out of this podcast. It'll certainly be much better than what we watched.
The scarecrow thing is fascinating too. Again, like this whole idea that Elphaba is actually the one who created the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Man, and the Scarecrow is like kind of interesting. And there's a thread there to pull and play with. And the movie is just resolutely
uninterested, totally uninterested.
It's not even uninterested. It resolutely runs away from all of these things, because as you say, to really, the only way this whole story works is if the Wicked Witch is not trying to burn the Scarecrow alive in her own castle and in the forest, you know, on the yellow brick road. Like, it only works if she is not having Bach beaten senseless by monkeys and, you know, jumped on and like the movie like it is so opposed to actually doing anything with any of the ideas other than saying like, you know, what's good is equality is good, and we should all be in, and we should be opposed to oppression, and we're and even the big idea of the film that it does kind of explore, which is this idea that people will believe whatever they're told. People want to believe the lie. People want to believe. They want to believe in the wizard. They want. They
but
have
also,
believed in the wizard.
Elphaba doesn't give them any actual reason not to. Right.
Right.
I mean, sky writes,
literally
he,
doing
he
skywriting
lies
like
the one time.
Her, yeah. Right. Yeah. But like, what does he lie about? How is he lying? Like,
he lies, you know, about his ability to use magic.
100%. But she doesn't say that. Right. I mean, literally, there is a crazy person wall in her treehouse that outlines like the underpants gnome theory of Ozzian politics.
She's,
it's like
she's got a Pepe Silver
wizard.
Wall.
Yeah. Like it is so politically immature that it actually like. It's just sort of repulsive, right?
To acknowledge any of this, to take the politics seriously, to take the ideas seriously, would be to undermine this movie's incredibly simplistic psychological fantasy, in which every single thing that the Wicked Witch of the West did in the original Wizard of Oz has to be retconned as actually good, because she is simply a misunderstood outsider who is being Mary Sued into, sort of the, being a great victim hero. She is just the victim. And that's why nothing in this movie makes any kind of psychological or human sense or political sense. That's why nothing about it works, is because that is its only mission at all times. All the stuff sort of even about like equality, about like, maybe we shouldn't Holocaust the animals or whatever. It's crazy. Like, it's just bizarre even to say those words. Like, all of that stuff is secondary at best and really completely unimportant to this movie's one and only mission, which is to make those outsiders feel like they're the hero, like they are perfect, like they have absolutely nothing wrong with them because the world misunderstands them. This movie is a bad therapist. This movie tells its hero and, yeah, frankly, I think a lot of its fans that everything that you have ever done in your life is perfect. And if people see you as bad, that's only because they're lying about you, because you're misunderstood, the world has problems, but you are the true hero of everything, even though you are the one who feels like the weirdo outsider. And that's it. There's nothing else to this movie except for some brutally ugly imagery. This is just an incredibly unpleasant movie to look at.
Yeah, no, it looks pretty bad.
Yeah.
John Chu knows how to design and shoot a like wildly over the top wedding. I don't know if you guys remember the sort of insane wedding sequence from Crazy Rich Asians, but he like hits a lot of the same notes here in the sort of Glinda Fiero wedding in ways that I found amusing.
Well, it's an interestingly empty movie also, not just in terms of the ideas, which we've gone on at length about here, but it's an interestingly empty movie in that, like, there's a real lack of extras. And am I crazy, or they have this wedding scene and there's like 15 people there for like the biggest wedding in the history of Oz, right? Like, I guess, I mean, there's more, I'm exaggerating slightly, but it is not
there's one, like, someone had flagged this before I saw the movie, so I was actually looking out for it. And there is one, I believe, shot in the Emerald City and sort of the downtown area where you do see a whole bunch of people, and it's very quick, and I'm pretty sure that most of those people were either CGI'd in or CGI'd as not necessarily as digital human beings, but as copied from the other people. That's how they did it with Game of Thrones. They shoot 30 guys and then like have each one of those, right? Like those blocks, right? Yeah. Sort of, they would replicate them. Anyway, like at every point in this movie just looks strangely inert and empty. It is the design seems the design is also just like weirdly glossy, like it's been glazed over to a point where nothing looks real anymore. It frequently, like some of the big effect sequences just look straight out of PS4. I don't even mean PS5. Like, this is a generation old video game at times. But even when there are human faces on screen, everything looks like it has been wrapped in cellophane. Like it's like you walked into the theater and there's like, here, we're going to put saran wrap over your face before you watch this. Everything's plastic and sort of unreal looking in a way that's like, I kept thinking throughout this movie, why is this whole thing not animated? What are these human beings doing on screen? Because none of them are allowed to not just act human, but even look human. They
barely look like flesh and blood. And it's bizarre. It's just a crazy choice. They've also, I mean, the way they've been lit, the way that they've been sort of digitally retouched, and then all of the backgrounds, all of the sets. Yes, some of the foregrounded sets do look like objects, but they look like really cheap, cheesy objects, just kind of plastic, almost like in a way that would look good perhaps on stage, that might look good on Broadway. But it looks like
you are in Disney World, right? Like yes. It looks like you are looking at a facsimile. And I will say one thing I found very weird and disturbing about the movie is that the one thing that looks really real and not in a good way is Ariana Grande, who looks worrisome in this movie.
You mean how skinny she is? People have commented on how skinny she is.
I find myself looking a lot at like just the amount of her bone structure that is visible and like her chest, her clavicles, like that is the realest looking thing in the movie. And I found myself being glad that my like newly image conscious 7-year-old doesn't watch movies, because I didn't really want to answer questions from her about like whether or not Ariana Grande looks good. Cause she does not look super healthy in this movie to me. And having that fact be the thing that sort of pierces the veil of the movie's just sort of fundamental, you know, manufacturedness. It's sort of the fact that it's a simulacra of itself made it very discordant to watch.
She definitely looks very thin. I don't know. You mentioned that the movie looks very like brown and drab, right? And I think this is intentional. I think this is a style choice, right? Like the first one is it's like happier and it's the Glinda focused movie more. So it's lighter and brighter and, you know, kind of pinker. And this is the movie where Elphaba, you know, is painted as evil. So it's brown and dark green and drab. And like, I get it, but it still looks bad. It's unpleasant to look at. It may be an intentional choice. I would wager it is an intentional choice. I bet there will be a featurette where somebody talks about the color palette of this movie being brown and olive green instead of the original, the first, you know, pink and white and blue.
I don't know about this movie, but I know that Chu and the production team actually talked extensively about how considered the colors and the imagery was in the first film. I can't imagine. That film was a huge hit. It's not like they rushed this one out in a way. It was like, we just got to do it because we committed to it. Like, I can't imagine that they didn't spend a significant amount of time choosing this look. And I don't understand it at all. Everything looks fake, weird, and terrible. And the lighting in particular is bad in a way that is more aggressive than some other films that I've seen recently, but does have this like continuity with a couple of movies that I've seen. We haven't talked about Frankenstein yet, but Frankenstein, and then even more than that, the movie we've talked about is Predator Badlands, both of which have this very digital light effect in which there is a very strong kind of glaring backlight that creates what in the world of video games they call lighting bloom. And this can work in movies when the light is real. Janusz Kaminski's work with Steven Spielberg often has a huge amount of lighting bloom attached to it, right? And it looks great. It sort of looks ethereal and mystical. And in this movie in particular, also in Predator Badlands, it just looks like a video game. It just looks like everything has been animated. It removes all of the edges and hardness and texture from any of the shot, from everything in a way that I just don't understand this choice, and I especially don't understand why this choice is being made across multiple movies.
Yeah. Can I just say the one thing that I thought this movie did better than the first installment?
Sure.
There is that. But in the first movie, like Defying Gravity is the banger to come out of the Wicked soundtrack. And they made what I thought was a very strange choice to chop it up. The Defying Gravity sequence in the first movie is, I think, almost 8 minutes long. And they interrupt it with dialogue. They break up the song a lot. And in this movie, they take the most important song, which is For Good, the Glinda and Elphaba duet, and they just let them sing it straight through. It is not broken up with dialogue. There are lots of nice close-ups of the actress's face. They just let the music breathe a little bit. And it is sort of the one moment in the movie that I enjoyed at all. It does not redeem the movie at all. But I think if you're going to make movie musicals, letting your songs shine, not sort of trying to milk them for more that they're worth, and just like letting the music be beautiful, I think is very important. And I was glad to see that they learned this lesson, even as they appear to have acquired some sort of amnesia for every other lesson of movie making.
All right. So what do we think about Wicked for Good? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Alyssa?
I mean, after I've said all of this, I have to acknowledge that I loved it. No, of course it's thumbs down.
Peter?
This movie provoked a kind of existential crisis for me. Like, I almost wondered, like, maybe we just want Netflix to kill movie theaters and movie going and all of movies. I don't know. It's so bad.
I'll take it. That's a thumbs down. Yeah. I will also give it a thumbs down. And I just feel like we really need to push for justice for Bach, who gets a real raw deal in this movie. That poor Tin Man. He did not deserve any of that. Just had his life ruined by these crazy ladies.
When the Gen Alpha produces their revisionist take on Wicked.
No, I was actually thinking about this. I was like, you know, sometimes I do bits where it's like, you know, the Empire is the real hero of Star Wars or whatever. And I was just like, you know, it turns out that the witch is actually the real villain of The Wizard of Oz. As it happens, the Wicked Witch of the West was the real villain. And I want to get the body horror David Cronenberg version of Bach's story next. Can we get Universal to give him $150 million to make one of these movies? I think that'd be awesome. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday. Remember, Friday, not Thursday, not Thanksgiving. You spend that time with your family and your TV, not with us. But we'll see you on Friday.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No.